Hi, this is Troy Stangeron, your host for Korean Context. This week, we talk with Carl Friedhoff of the Asan Institute about public opinion trends in South Korea.
Public opinion plays an important role in helping to shape public policy for policymakers in a democracy. To start, why don't you give us a little bit of background on the work that the Public Opinion Study Center does at Asan?
Well, one of the things I think that we're really lucky to have at Asan is a very robust polling center. And so we do, I think, the most extensive polling work in Korea. And we're also, right now, the only one that really focuses on getting our numbers out in English, doing in-depth analysis, and distributing that to the D.C. audience and general interest around. And the way that we do our polling, right now we're doing a daily poll. And it's a three-day rolling average. You know, it's all nationally representative. And so far, I think our numbers have been very accurate. You know, they've helped us through the last elections, and we were fairly accurate throughout those as well. So overall, right now, things are going very well for us, and the work has been incredibly fascinating.
Speaking of the last election, South Korea has a new president, Park Geun-hye. She came to office during perhaps one of the more challenging periods for a transition of any Korean president. North Korea took and tested a long-range missile, the nuclear test. There's also been a significant increase in the amount of rhetoric coming out of the North. How have perspectives of her job performance held up under these kinds of circumstances, and how does she compare to prior presidents' approval ratings?
So I guess I'll take that in a couple parts. And first, we have to go back a bit and really cover what happened when she came into office. I'm sure as everyone listening, well, hopefully, well, maybe not everyone, but there is this idea that she was going to be the least popular president upon entering office in Korea's short democratic history. And Gallup Korea had produced numbers that showed her being at 41, 44% approval just after she entered office. And the media really picked this up, and they started to put that out there. But from my view, and I had said this to several people, and I tried to write about it a bit, was that that number I found to be very misleading. Because the numbers that we were producing at the same time, and this is still true throughout, that we're generally about 10 percentage points higher than all the other polling. And so when they were reporting that she was at 41 to 44%, you know, maybe I'm biased towards my own numbers because I'm more familiar with them and I deal with them and I know how the methodology works. I didn't buy that she was at 41 to 44%. So I did some looking into it, and through the reports that were issued with this, the breakdown was generally, okay, so 41 or 44% approve of her, but nearly one-third of the entire sample were I don't knows. And that's basically an unacceptably high number of I don't knows. And what I figured out is probably this comes down to the way that the methodology was done. So the way that we do it and the way that it's done here as well, I know it's done for a fact, ABC does it this way, I believe Washington Post does it this way, you try to lean the I don't knows. So these people say, well, I don't know, and then you ask them a follow-up. Yes, we know that you said you don't know, but if you had to choose, which way would you go, approve or disapprove? And when we did that, we get our numbers down to about 10% don't knows. And if I look at the first pass and break down the numbers, our numbers look just like Gallup's, 41 or 44%. And this large number of I don't know. So you have to press them a bit. Because if they don't have an opinion on that, which is that's the most basic kind of opinion, how can you trust their opinion on anything else? So you have to try to lean them. But Gallup Korea doesn't do this, as far as I know. And so they get these numbers, 33%. And 41% approval, and of course it fits the media narrative that she's not popular. And they run with it, and those numbers go out, and it can actually have a spiral effect where maybe it will have a knock-on effect of later approval. But just recently, Gallup Korea's numbers have started to change. Why, I'm not sure, but just last week they produced 60% approval. A far different change, and much higher than anything else. And I don't know if this is a methodology change, or perhaps they are starting to try to lean the I don't know respondents, but in any case, you know, that's the one thing that we're dealing with.
60% sounds much more like an early presidential term approval rating.
Right.
Speaking of the perspectives of Park Geun-hye, she is the first female president in South Korea. Is there anything that you can see when you look beneath the data in terms of, are there generational divides in her support? Is there a gender gap in terms of, anecdotally speaking, when I was in Seoul prior to the election, you know, I would talk to some of my female friends, and they would say, yes, we'll support her because she is a woman. So, I mean, is there some of that taking place as well?
I'll deal with the gender gap first. In general, what we've seen going back, I think, and since we started tracking her, is that women are going to be more favorable towards her than men. As far as I can remember, at times it will be within the margin of error, and sometimes there have been maybe one or two times where we've done this polling where men are actually more approving of Pakenhe, but only once or twice. In general, women are going to be 7 to 10 percentage points higher in approval than men towards Pakenhe. We've seen that. It's been very consistent. It will fluctuate, and that 7 to 10 is important because that's actually outside the margin of error. Mm-hmm. And so we know that there is a real difference, and it's fairly persistent over time. As far as the generational gap, this is one thing I've been watching since she came into office, and it really looks to me like she could end up being a lot like Lee Myung-bak in terms of her approval, where you have 70% or 80% of people in their 60s approving of her, and the 50s will come in at about the mid-70s, maybe mid-60s, and the 40s, 30s, and 20s are all going to group together, and they're going to look at about 50% right now. And so you're having already this big gap. So even her approval, even though her approval is high, there is quite a gap between the generations. And as she goes on, I would expect to see that the 40s, 30s, and 20s, there will be a much larger decline for them as opposed to the 50s and 60s. So there will be some decline for the 50s and 60s, but they'll still end up supporting her throughout her term. And even as she gets lower, the 40s, 30s, and 20s will just bottom out as her term progresses.
This generational gap, if you will, is somewhat interesting because having looked through some of Aung San's other polling data, we see some generational gaps when it comes to security issues. So it's somewhat intriguing that you have these different types of gaps going on. I guess could you tell us a little bit about the security gap and then how it's actually different, but perhaps a possibility for her to build support amongst other generational groups?
Right. One of the misunderstandings, I think, is that these things do break down along generations. Actually, from what I've done through regression analysis and whatnot, it actually looks more like an ideological gap. And it's a little tricky because age cohorts and ideology are so closely related that if you're 50 and 60, you're going to be conservative. If you're 30 and 40 and 20s, you're going to be progressive. And so it's actually not really an age. It's just how you identify as an ideology. But there is a gap, and you can't address it by age as well. And so you have these gaps. But the one thing that we're finding that I find really fascinating is that the 20s, even though they look very progressive as in terms of domestic affairs, when it comes to terms of international security and specifically on North Korea, the 20s actually look like the 60s. They don't identify with the 30s and 40s at all. And so when we ask questions like, well, you know, favorability, how do you view North Korea? Do you view it as one of us or an enemy or a stranger or just a neighbor? It's the 20s and the 60s who are most likely to identify it as an enemy. And it's the 20s and 60s who are the least likely to identify North Korea as one of us. And of course, that has important implications for reunification, especially when I think the theoretical underpinning for reunification is that Koreans are of one blood. And so if people in their 20s are not viewing North Koreans as one of us, what's going to happen as they age? Now, there is a chance that the age effect could take hold and they'll slowly, you know, perhaps get more in touch with their Korean roots, so to speak. And over time, they'll say, well, North Koreans are one of us. We really need to reunify. But if that doesn't happen, the actual push for reunification could start to die out. And, you know, if reunification doesn't happen soon and you're going to wait 30, 40, 50 years, which we've already been waiting for this, then the reunification picture potentially looks much different.
There's definitely some interesting policy implications there. But speaking of policy, when you look at the United States, for us, the big issue is often North Korea. But when you ask South Korea's domestic public, what issues matter for them, you know, especially given what's gone on over the last few months, is North Korea the public's primary concern, or do other issues rise to the forefront?
Well, North Korea is highly reactive, especially South Korean public attitudes towards North Korea are highly reactive to the behavior of North Korea. So throughout last year, all the time during the elections, the National Assembly election in April, the December presidential election, you know, there were two missile launches during that time. And those caused almost no spike at all in South Korean attitudes towards the issues most important to the nation. So at that time, you know, North Korea was seen as the least important of the four or five issues we listed. And there was just small spikes for each launch. And at the presidential election, still very low, less than 10%. No movement at all. But then we have this nuclear test, and suddenly the importance of North relations to the South Korean people starts to spike, where for 1 month it becomes, within the margin of error, it becomes the nation's most important issue. So it goes from less than 10% to greater than 30%, and it actually edges out job creation. So it edges that out. But then, within the next months, things kind of quiet down, they get calmer, and immediately there's a huge decline. So it actually looks like an inverted V. It goes from very low to very high, and then immediately starts to decline once again. So right now, the South Korean people, they look at North Korea, they're reactive to it, they perceive that there are these things going on, there are increased security threats. We can talk about that as well, as opposed to current versus future security threats. But the main issues have really been job creation.
Well, how does the security threat play out? Because during much of the last few months, when the North Korean issue was on international news, there was a lot of discussion about, would this break out into a conflict? Are we looking at, maybe another war? I know one network put on sort of what potential invasion routes might be. I guess the question is if the outside world views these types of situations as being very dangerous, how do South Koreans themselves view these situations? Do they have a greater sense of insecurity, or is this something to where it's almost sort of like, been there, done that, I know what's going to happen, and move on with daily life?
Yeah, I think that I'll start with that international media perspective, because that kind of provides the backdrop. I think a lot of people who are going to be listening to this, they have a background in Korea, they kind of know how it is on the ground there. And, I've been based in Seoul for 10 years, and when this was all going on, I did a radio interview with a broadcaster in Italy. And one of the first questions was, are there soldiers in the streets? And that really kind of caught me off guard. I had never expected that question to come out just because it's so far out of my mind. And as I thought about it, why would this question come up? I thought, and my answer to her was, maybe technically, yes, there are, because there are the military exercises going on. And all of the soldiers, because it's conscription, they, after they're out of the service, they have to go back for training. And so it's nothing. You see people walking on the street in their military fatigues, but they're wearing gym shoes. They're wearing their backpacks. They're drinking a Starbucks coffee. So technically, I guess you could say there were soldiers in the street, but not in the context that she was asking. And so I had to go through and kind of explain that. But so there's that perspective. And then there's what's happening in South Korea. And there was a lot of, speculation, a lot of hand-wringing about, why aren't South Koreans reacting to this? And I think this is something that our polling really highlighted, especially the fact that we do it on a daily basis. And one of the things we track is the perceptions of current and future national security. And what we saw is that positive perceptions of current national security at that time, current national security, were about 30%. And then all these tensions start to come up. And it was 30% consistently over a couple months. And then we have all these things come up, and then it literally cuts in half, where it gets down to 15 to 10%. So in that current perception, there's a huge drop. But what did not happen was that there was not a corresponding drop for positive perceptions of future national security. So there was an idea that there could be this provocation, something could happen in the short term, but in the long term, nothing's going to change. And those positive perceptions of future national security stayed between 50 and 60%. Which is a huge difference from the view of the current situation. And so because of that, I think that's really why we didn't see any, there were no raids on the major retailers, people stockpiling water, stockpiling ramen noodles. That kind of stuff didn't happen because the long-term security perceptions weren't affected.
Well, if the long-term security perceptions weren't affected, is this a aspect of either comfort in the U.S. security alliance or does it play into just more North Korea's past behaviors?
Yeah, the security alliance is difficult to say. I guess I'll start with the North Korea behavior. I think that's just part of life in South Korea at this point. It's factored in. You can see that even foreign investors have factored that in, where they don't react to it anymore either. And, they have their money on the line. South Koreans, of course, have their life on the line, which is hopefully viewed
slightly
as
more valuable.
Viewed as more valuable. But I think it's a psychological effect where you can't go around living life every day on a daily basis thinking of what is North Korea going to do. Is today the day? And especially, I think no one really takes North Korea seriously anymore because of the amount of threats and the tones of which they really threaten South Korea. As far as confidence in the U.S. and the alliance, So last year we did a couple surveys, and one of the questions, well, two of the questions. First question was, do you think that South Korea alone can deter North Korea from provoking a war? And the second question was, do you think if the war does break out, do you think that South Korea alone can win a war? Three quarters said no. So there's not much confidence that South Korea alone can defend against North Korea. And so that does point to the confidence in the U.S. But when we ask, you know, well, if there was a nuclear first strike by North Korea on South Korea, do you think the U.S. would respond in kind? And that is less than 50%. So this idea of extended deterrence, you know, there's not that much confidence in it. It's about 50%, and that could certainly change. And the U.S. tried to affect that with B-52 flyovers, B-2 flyovers. But our polling data on security and perceptions of that showed almost no reaction whatsoever. So it's not clear that had any effect. But that's extended deterrence is perhaps a different issue. Overall, though, there has been very high support for the alliance. And even there's been a clear majority, I believe almost 70%, support the long-term stationing of U.S. troops in South Korea. And that really points first at North Korea, but it also, if you look into the numbers and start running it through regression analysis, also points at China.
Interesting. We'll move to China in a moment, but one last question on North Korea before we do. Have you done any polling on sort of what policy options South Koreans think should be taken? You know, Park Geun-hye has this policy of trust politique. So sort of how does the South Korean public perceive what South Korea should be doing?
Yeah, I think there is, you know, coming out of the Im Young-bak administration where it was basically no talks no matter what. And that was kind of the feeling, and the feeling that North Korea was in the driver's seat. You know, that there is a change, and there was a drive within public sentiment that there does need to be further engagement with North Korea, but they don't want engagement for engagement's sake. You know, they are also in favor of economic sanctions. So you have these two kind of conflicting things. We want to sanction them, but we also want to talk with them. Part of that polling that came out also showed that there was fairly high favorability for a preemptive strike on North Korea's nuclear test sites. But if you follow that up, you know, there was one of the response options. But if you followed it up, it was 58% were afraid of that provoking a war. And so this consider military response, I think, should not be taken too seriously. So right now, I think the Park Geun-hye administration has a difficult task. But so far, it seems to be handling it very well. This idea that, well, we have to engage, but we can't be too soft. And it's a very fine balance. But so far, the South Korean public has reacted very positively, I think, to what she's done.
Well, moving now to a more regional perspective. In your annual survey, you do favorability ratings for essentially the prime foreign policy partners of South Korea. How do the different countries tend to rank, and has there been a significant shift in how South Koreans view them?
Well, on that, the U.S. has always been the most favored. And I think that's not a surprise, given, you know, there's a lot of attention paid to the danger, the flash spots with the military there. But overall, with the cultural ties, the educational ties, there's always been a fairly good relationship, and especially over the past 10 years, they've gotten much better at alliance management. And with that, the U.S. is going to be the most favorable. The least favorable, and this has actually changed somewhat because South Korean public opinion is so reactive to North Korea, for when we did this, I believe Japan was the least favored, under North Korea even. And since, that has actually shifted, where with all of the recent tensions and all of the bad blood, that North Korea is now seen as less favorable. So there is some shift, and there's always going to be that shift between Japan and North Korea. It depends on who's ever seen as acting worse. And they've both done very well recently.
Not in the way you might want to do well, perhaps.
Yes. And as for China, you know, that's one of the most interesting findings is that right now I think South Koreans are really split on how they view China. So we asked them, well, how do you see China's economic rise? And a majority will say, well, it's about split actually, 48 I think to 52, very close. Is it an opportunity or is it a threat? And the majority will say that it's an opportunity. But if you break that down by age, there's a huge split where people who are young see it more as an opportunity. And people who are old see economic rise more as a threat. And that might be tied into how these different generations view Korea's economy. But when you ask about the military rise, across the board, from 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, three-quarters of every age group sees China's military rise as a threat, and I find that to be very interesting.
No, there's a lot of interesting data in there on sort of how China is perceived. You have another interesting statistic, which is the competitive cooperative relationship. Mm-hmm. And looking through it, you know, there's some interesting perspectives on how U.S.-China relations are viewed, mm-hmm. but even how ROK-China relations are viewed.
I think it's not that surprising that the ROK-U.S. relationship, highly cooperative. ROK-Japan, highly competitive. U.S.-China is seen as very competitive. I will give this one update that we've done this more recently, and this is after all of the North Korea tensions and talk of potential provocations and just everything that's happened. That has actually changed quite a bit. So what we have in the first survey in September of 2012 is 81% see U.S.-China relations as competitive. Now that's almost evenly split. So it was 81-19, and now it's almost an even split. Why that has happened, it might be potentially wishful thinking that they see a larger area for cooperation and the new leadership in China, and there does seem to be better communication, and they seem to be on the same page with regards to North Korea. That's changed. But the ROK-China relationship is a difficult one for South Koreans, because on one hand, it's the largest economic partner, but at the same time, it's the largest benefactor to its primary security threat in North Korea. And so there is this, you know, two minds right now in South Korea on China, and they're watching it very warily. I'll tie this into some of the more recent research I've done, breaking these numbers down. So one of the things that we have is very high support for the U.S. alliance, like 94-95%, the highest I think it's ever been and the highest we've seen it. Of course, that can change very quickly. But we also asked a follow-up question is on, do you support the U.S. pivot to Asia? And to get around the wording, we actually explain, you know, they're going to take on more diplomatic and more diplomatic and military focus on Asia. Do you support that? So we don't use the word pivot, because that can be potentially troublesome. And it's only something like 54% support that. So you have 94 or 95% support the alliance, and 54% support the pivot, which, you know, that's an interesting gap. And so what I tried to do is first identify the people who supported one but not the other, and then look at the regression analysis about what makes them switch. And things like ideology are important. So there are certain demographic factors that are important. Ideology is important, but not age, because ideology and age are closely linked, as we mentioned before. So age doesn't really matter in terms of statistical significance. So it's ideology. Gender also matters a bit. Region doesn't matter that much. North Korea matters, but not very much. The two biggest drivers are actually China, where you say, you know, how do you view China as favorability? And on that, you know, if you're more favorable towards China, you are less likely to support the U.S. pivot. And I think that's a very interesting idea. And I think the idea is that, well, once this pivot starts to happen, you're going to exacerbate tensions in the region rather than alleviate them. And so Koreans are put in this interesting position where they're right in the middle.
Well, this is an interesting relationship. And I think sometimes when we look at some of the data, it's interesting when you ask questions slightly different ways. I mean, I remember James Kim had done, for one of his issue briefs, a polling sample. And rather than ask, do you support the alliance, he asked, are you favorable to the United States, and got a lower number. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think there's some difference between sort of how you view the country, how you view the military alliance, these types of things.
That wording is important, especially for snapshots, but it can become a little less important when you run it over time. And you have enough measurements that you can start to read in, okay, well, we know that there's this problem with the wording, but the wording is consistent.
Yeah.
And so that problem kind of becomes systematic and built in, and then you can still read into it a little bit.
Well, I was actually just more even getting into the idea that people in their minds, I think, tend to separate out sort of different aspects of it, and that, you know, we shouldn't maybe look at one and think that that means everything is really, really well, because supporting very highly one aspect of a relationship might not mean the whole relationship is in the same position.
Right, and this gets into polling in general, right, is that there's not much trust in public opinion polling in South Korea, even though that, and I think this goes back to the fact that the way that the newspapers reported. So the newspapers, we previously talked about Park Geun-hye's approval ratings. They picked up on something that fit their narrative, they reported it, and they omitted crucial element of how the poll was done, and one of the important results, they just glossed over it. But also, these polling companies, when they get their numbers out, I think they're really failing the public in the fact that they only produce the top-line numbers, and they get those out, and I don't think they're doing a good enough job at actually breaking the numbers down, looking two or three levels deep and cross-cutting the data to look at, well, we have these top-line numbers, but those don't tell us very much. What you have to do is get down into the data and form a much bigger picture. And I think that's one of the challenges of being, you know, a quote-unquote pollster, is that you get so locked into the methodology, so locked into the question wording, it's all you focus on, and you stop paying attention to the larger picture. And it's really the larger picture what you're trying to inform. And your numbers shouldn't drive the story. The story should be the story,
yeah.
And the numbers should fit in to support that. And so far, I think the Korean polling companies haven't really done that.
Speaking of the larger story, we've talked a little bit about how supportive South Koreans are of the alliance, but how they also have these divided perspectives of China's rise as a military and economic power and what it means for South Korea. Have you done any polling on sort of looking to the future, what they believe South Korea should do? You know, we often talk about maintaining the strength of the alliance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are South Koreans primarily interested in maintaining the alliance? Are they primarily interested in changing their relationship with China? Sort of how do these things play out?
Yeah, we've done one question on that. I don't think we've updated it since last September. And as I remember, most people were in favor of forging this new relationship with China, even if it meant damaging the alliance with the U.S. I would take that with a major grain of salt. Some things are too complex to do polling. You need kind of an elite opinion. But on this, I think, you know, it's there. We've reported it. And it has to be taken with a major grain of salt. Because if things were really going to damage the alliance with the U.S., and you started to see the results of that, I think there would be a major shift immediately. And, you know, and it will highly depend on China's actions as well. So I don't want to go too much into the depth of that. You know, Koreans are in a tough spot right now. And they're trying to walk this line. They don't want to be too committed to the U.S. They don't want to be too committed to China. And, you know, that's where they are. Luckily, they have a rich, you know, historical legacy of doing this. This has always been kind of the situation for them, balancing between great powers.
Well, speaking of balancing between great powers, there's one power in the region we haven't really talked about much. You know, you briefly mentioned that up until recently, Japan was seen very unfavorably within South Korea. Sort of, where do you see Japan in the polling data in terms of broader issues, in terms of alliance cooperation, the ROK-Japan alliance, or, you know, broader regional issues?
Yeah, Japan is one of the really tough things to poll on in South Korea, because as soon as you mention it, you're calling on this large kind of cultural force, this large historical force, that it's within the minds of everyone. So anytime you mention Japan, there's going to be a negative reaction. And so, you know, the polling on that can be difficult to do. It's also like asking South Koreans, should it have an independent, you know, ballistic missile defense? And of course, anytime you mention independent and South Korea in the same sentence, there's going to be strong support for that. So you really have to parse these things carefully. As far as, you know, the Korea-Japan relations, I think one of the trends that we've seen over the past year, 2 years, is that Korea is really taking a stronger stance towards Japan. And one of the things that we've done that I find very interesting is we asked these the South Korean public about influence on global affairs for countries involved in the region. So the U.S., China, Japan, and South Korea, and Russia was included as well. We omitted North Korea from this. And current influence on global affairs, the U.S. is seen as being the strongest influence. China's number two, Russia's number three, Japan's number four, and South Korea is number five. They rank themselves as the least influential currently. And then we asked them, okay, how about in 10 years? Who do you think is going to be the most influential, or how influential, not who do you think will be the most, but how influential do you think each country will be on a scale of 0 to 10? And what has caught the most attention is that the U.S. and China have now flipped places, that South Koreans perceive China as being more influential than the U.S. on global affairs 10 years from now. That's caught a lot of attention, but what I found most interesting is that the relationship between South Korea and Japan, that South Koreans see Japan as declining and South Korea is rising, and now South Korea is going to be more influential than Japan and as influential as Russia. Of course, that last part, I think, is obviously a pipe dream.
Because, you know, the Russian side, a lot of that's tied into their own nuclear stockpile and everything.
Right. But when you get down to this, that this perception that South Korea is on the rise, if you live in South Korea, you've probably seen it. It's everywhere. Like, there's such a brimming confidence, especially from people in their 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
You know, they're like, well, we're Koreans. My idea is that there's a fundamental identity change going on. We can get into that as well. But this idea is that South Korea is now going to be more influential. They're not willing to take some of Japan's, I don't want to call them provocations, but, you know, more strongly worded statements and revisionist whatever. They're not willing to take that lying down. And now they're reacting more forcefully to it. And I think over the next 10 years, this is kind of the new norm, is that Korea is there's a fundamental realignment of Korea-Japan relations going on.
I mean, it's interesting that you talk about South Koreans' own identity, and that one of the big pushes of the prior administration was this idea of global Korea.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the current administration is still young. North Korea has obviously eaten up a lot of the foreign policy oxygen.
Right.
But do you see in your polling Koreans seeing themselves as not just having this more influence, but playing a greater role in other issues?
Yeah, we haven't done any polling specifically on should Korea take on a larger role in the world. And if we have, you know, we have so much data, perhaps we've done it and it's just buried somewhere in a drawer. And I could certainly dig that out. But on their role in the world, you know, with the growing confidence, yeah, absolutely. Korea now views itself as becoming a major global player, and they want to see that continue. I don't think there's any interest that South Korea should now suddenly pull back. And especially, we talked about this identity shift. This is a bit of hypothesizing on my part, and I haven't done and kind of gone back and looked at it, and perhaps people listening to this will have a different view, and I'd be very interested to hear about it. But my view of the people in their 20s is that they're the first South Koreans to grow up truly affluent throughout their entire life. So the developmental story that is so core to people in their 50s and 60s is now fading for them. And what I've seen and what I think is happening is that they no longer define their national identity in terms of opposition. So they don't say, well, we're not Japan, we're Korean. We're not China, we're Korean. We're not the U.S., we're Korean. It's now, we're just Koreans. And, you know, we're a prosperous nation, we're rising. We have this newfound confidence. And I think that is something that really needs to be looked into carefully, because my discussions around town while I've been in D.C. is that there's also a new rising cohort of people in their 20s in Japan that might be seeing the same thing. There's this trend towards nationalism, perhaps in China. And if that's going to happen, you have all these young people in their 20s coming up feeling more confident in their countries. That's potentially problematic.
Before we let you go, is there any other trends you see in the polling data that are interesting, things that we should be aware of in terms of how South Koreans are viewing certain issues?
The more provocations that come out of North Korea, the softer policy would be coming out of South Korea, because the 40s and the 30s had a more friendly attitudes towards North Korea. But that has been broken. And so that idea is not holding up. People in their 20s, you know, they've been on the front lines of these provocations. The men have to do their conscription military service, but it doesn't just affect them, because you also get the women. They lose brothers, they lose boyfriends, they lose close friends to the military, and they're put right in harm's way, potentially. And so people in their 20s, I think also part of this newfound confidence is that they're not willing to put up with North Korea's actions. And so they're going to take a much harder line on that. So I think that's also really interesting to watch.
Okay. Well, thank you. This has been a very interesting look into Korean public perceptions. And thank you for joining us on Korean Context.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.